This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Veterans Day edition of our program, hearing from three men from three different states who found themselves in the very same skies over Merseburg, Germany 75 years ago. In addition to 638 bombers, there were over 600 American fighters in the air on November 2nd, 1944. In total, 76 U.S. planes were shot down, and 481 of those 638 bombers were damaged. It wasn't just the incredible wall of flak protecting the synthetic oil factory in Merseburg, but over 700 German fighter planes in the air as well, including some ME-262 jets that those Allied crews were encountering for the first time. Al Porta was a 21-year-old from Spokane, Washington, a B-17 pilot who cared deeply about his 10-man crew.
They were all great guys. I lost three of them the day I was shot down because I had a fire in Bombay. My number three engine was on fire, and probably my number three tank was also ruptured, and the fuel was flowing into the bomb bays, because when I opened the bomb bay door, the fire just engulfed me. So the only thing I could do was just jump out, because that was my exit for bombing, is to go back through the airplane and see that everyone got through, got out. But I couldn't do that because of the fire in Bombay.
We're talking about November 2nd, 1944, your 17th mission. So you had had these 16 missions. Had you had some close calls before that? Had you been shot up a little bit in those first 16 missions?
Yes, I'll give you an example of two of the hairiest ones. About the 12th mission there, my waist gunner got a piece of flak right in the pressure point of his leg. Some of them went back the waist area, and the blood was flown profusely out of his left leg. So we put a tourniquet on him. It was 40 degrees below zero. He'd lost so much blood by that time that I was afraid he'd lose his leg. So we pulled him into the radio room and put him up on his foot. We had electric muffs that we used to stick our hands into, and it was maybe 10 degrees warmer in the radio room than it was in the waist gunner's position. That was the coldest position of the waist gunner. So then we got back to the cockpit. I pulled the crew, asked him. I said, he's going to lose his leg if we don't get him down where it's warmer. And I'm asking you guys, this is pretty risky because we have to hit the deck and go home alone without any fighter escort. And they all voted to hit the deck. So after we hit the deck, I ordered the ball turret gunner and all the other gunners to take their crash position, because I said, if we get attacked, I'm going in. I'm going to crash land the airplane. So fortunately, we didn't get any attacks. And we got a little ground fire. Some of the guys reported some ground fire. Other than that, but that was five hairy hours on the deck.
So you were able to make it all the way back to England flying how low off the ground?
50 feet, maybe.
You know what you just said, but I want to make sure all our listeners understand what you just said. Basically, you're saying here you have the luxury of a formation and fighter escort that you could take all the way home with you, and this guy might lose his leg. Or you could put the other nine lives on board in jeopardy to get him back safely and save that leg. And you guys chose to put your own lives on the line to save his leg.
That's correct.
What did that say to you about the kind of men you had on board?
Well, they were, like I say, they were great. From the day I met them, all of them were eager to fight. Every day when we had a mission assigned, no arguments, packed their gear and get in the airplane, away we'd go. And we had another mission. Ooh, that must have been about 14... was it very close to the time that Gorse got injured. And on that mission, as I was forming up over England, I lost the turbo on number two engine. I didn't think that was a reason to abort the mission, so we went on. Got over the target. My number one engine started to, prop started to run away. The prop control was malfunctioning, so the only way I could control that is with a feathering button. What the feathering button does, when you lose an engine, it feathers a prop, so it reduces drag. But I used it to control the prop. We got the bombs away, and I told the navigator, I says, well, pick it out closest to the our friendly lines, and because we got ahead there, we can't keep up with the formation. He says, okay, turn right, about 30 degrees or something like that. I had no more, turned right, and a piece of flak, I got a flak right in number four engine. So that one was dead. So I feathered number four. So now I'm flying with number one running away, number two turbocharged, which is only about half the horsepower at 30,000 feet. I had one good engine, and number four was feathered. And there again, I says, guys, I can't keep up with the formation. We got to hit the deck. So same procedure, hit the deck, took their crash positions, got back home.
You described that so calmly, but again, you're a 21-year-old kid with all these other lives that you're responsible for. How nerve-wracking was that to go the rest of the way back to home base? And what were you doing up in that cockpit? Are you clenching your teeth? Are you saying a prayer? Are you closing your eyes? What are you doing?
Not too much. You got your hands full flying the airplane, and you kind of looking out for ground fire, especially when you're close to the deck. And concerned about it, but not much I can do about it. I don't have any guns other than a .45 in my shoulder harness that I can use.
That's about a week before you end up being shot down on your 17th mission, but I'm wondering, had that stuff started to wear on you? Did you ever find yourself afraid that each mission would be your last?
I was 21 years old, you're indestructible at 21. I would go into town and hit the bars, nights off. So when I'd come home at night, we had three crews in our hut. Some of them still be up crying. It'd be 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd jump in my bunk and go sound asleep. Like I say, I was too young to have any fear.
And I guess that served you well. Well, tell me about that 17th and final mission. Your target was Merseburg, Germany?
Everything was pretty normal. Our navigator took us about 30 miles off course. Well, that took us out of fighter protection. So the Germans spotted that right away, and they come up in 109s, and they knocked down nine of us. There again, helpless, no guns to shoot. I don't know what's going on. I know that they're shooting at the fighters by the vibration of the airplane. When I saw number three engine was on fire, feathered the prop, and that didn't stop the fire, and gave the order to bail out. So right after I gave the order, I dropped down to the lower part of the airplane, opened the door to the bomb bay, and it was completely engulfed in fire and burned my face and hands. Slammed the door and jumped out. The hatch is right there going down. I didn't see our airplane explode, but it exploded. It was reported that it exploded about maybe 10 seconds after we bailed out. No, I said, God, don't let them kill me. And that's was my prayer on the way down.
Where'd you land? Where'd you come down?
Come down in a little farming community in Blankenheim, Germany. Fortunately, we ran into the Volkssturm, the old guard. The German seniors were not committed to the front lines. They just did police work. I was very fortunate that they were there, because some of the guys got picked up by the SS and they didn't make it to prison camp.
But what's going through your mind? I mean, I'm sure you hadn't planned on being captured and being a prisoner of war.
Pretty much in shock. The pain in my hands and face, with no treatment in sight, that was probably the most miserable 3 days I ever spent in my life. We ran into other prisoners, and I couldn't even feed myself. They had to feed me, take me to the bathroom, and I probably was in shock for 3 days.
When did you finally get some relief?
About 3 days later. at Frankfurt. They weren't too hard on me, name, rank, and serial number. They told me more about myself than I told them.
You're being held by the enemy and dependent on them for medical treatment. How did they treat you? Did you sense some compassion in their medical people?
Yes, absolutely. You know, they took real care of me, good care of me. No painkillers. They put my hands in a purple solution, soaking there. Took a tweezer and pulled all the skin off my hands. So that was testy, but I knew that they would heal.
Good old gentian violet, huh?
I don't know what it was. Is that what they called it? A disinfectant of some kind. But I didn't get any infection, even after the 3 days. They were swollen bad.
So they take you to Stalag 3A. Tell us where that was and what that journey was like.
Well, that was mostly by train, that we didn't have to walk.
40 and eights?
Yes. The Stalag 3 was filled up, the American Stalag 3. So Stalag 3A was for the Australians, New Zealanders, and the English. Some of those guys had been there since the war began, 5 or 6 years. I remember the one groupies on sand. If I'm in this prison camp another year, I'm going to cut my throat.
So did they show you the ropes a little bit?
Oh, yeah. They really told us what was going on. We were interrogated to make sure that we weren't German spies. Of course, the fact that my hands were still bandaged, my face was still bandaged, they pretty much figured that I was an American. We had a good security system. We had a radio. Got the news. We knew what was going on. I was about 210, went down to 150, about 10 pounds a month.
And as those weeks and months go by, were you able to keep your spirits up? Were you starting to get a little hopeless, demoralized? How did that work for you?
I don't think I ever got hopeless because, like I say, we had radios and we knew that it was just a matter of time. In fact, the groupies said, we're not going to try to escape. Because it won't be long. The Americans or the English will be here to liberate us. We just went by the news all the time. Because just before, maybe 6 months before I got there, they had 3 tunnels dug out of the prison. 66, I think, got out. And they were captured. And Hitler ordered them killed. So they killed 66. And then they found the other tunnel, so that was the end of that escapade. So
you knew you weren't escaping. I'm just curious what it was that kept you believing things would be okay. I mean, was it just the strength of numbers with the other POWs? Was it something about your upbringing, your faith? What do you think it was?
I guess it was more or less my upbringing, my faith. Prayed to God every day.
Did your family know you were a prisoner?
They knew I was missing in action. That's all they knew.
What do you think is the worst thing, the most difficult thing that you had to endure?
I think it's psychological. Yeah. It's psychological. You can only get so scared. And then after that, you got to say to yourself, am I going to go crazy or am I going to get out of this? So you make up your mind right there that you're going to go with the flow, trust in God, that you're going to get liberated without getting killed. Yeah, other things to occupy your mind as soon as you are liberated, you know, dwell on that. The only thing that bothers me is losing those 3 kids. They were 18 years old when I went to the war memorial, and they had the stars for those killed in action. I said 3 of those stars belonged to my crew members, and little did I know that each star was 100. But I said they deserve one big star.
To finally get back to America and to see your family again and have them realize you aren't dead out there somewhere, you're alive. What was that like for you?
Well, that was really great. My mother was very weepy. She cried all the time. And I'm sure it was her prayers that kept us alive, because I had a brother who was a P-38 pilot, and he finished up his tour in Europe and came home. Another brother was in the 1st Marine Division. He made 3 landings in the South Pacific, and he came home alive. So We all said it was her prayers that brought us all back alive.
Al Porta passed away in 2013 at the age of 90, but he touched so many lives, including many fellow veterans in his retirement years as he volunteered at the VA in Reno, Nevada. We're not done yet with this Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes. When we come back, another man who spent Armistice Day 75 years ago praying an armistice would come quickly in World War II. His story is one you can read about in a book, and I'll tell you more about it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.